750 BBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. Hidden voices is our focus this week on the Vermont Conversation. People and places around Vermont who are not ordinarily heard from. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking with women in prison who are now in a writing program, and we'll be speaking with a former woman prisoner as well as the co-editor of a book that's recently come out, a collection of writings from incarcerated women. But first, we'll be talking with filmmakers who are making a film about people being prosecuted for downloading child pornography. Possession and distribution of internet child porn is one of the fastest-growing prosecuted crimes in the U.S., increasing 150% every year since the mid-2000s. Yet meaningful conversations about why people download child porn and the potential of rehabilitation are almost non-existent. A new documentary film, End of Love, raises important questions about a taboo subject and shows how child porn destroys the lives of vulnerable youth on both sides of the screen. The film is directed by two Vermont filmmakers, Deb Ellis and Alex Halkin. Deb Ellis is associate professor in the Film and Television Studies program at the University of Vermont. Her past films include the Academy Award shortlisted film Howard Zinn, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. Alexandra Halkin is a Guggenheim Fellow and Fulbright Scholar who founded the Chiapas Media Project, which has trained indigenous men and women in video production in Mexico. Deb and Alex, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks for having us.
So, how did the issue of child pornography come onto your radar screen? And Alex, you can start first.
Well, for me, it was really interesting because it actually had to do with the work I was doing in Chiapas, Mexico, with the Zapatista communities, and finding that one of the filmmakers who was working in our office in San Cristobal, de las Casas, accidentally clicked on an email link to a porn site in Germany that dialed up the site, and we ended up getting a huge phone bill from that. And that was back in 2001. And I just thought, what is going on here? How is this possible that pornography, a porn site in Germany, is reaching out to an indigenous filmmaker in southern Mexico?
And Deb Ellis.
I became interested in the issue of pornography in a general way, I think, because I raised boys in my house. And you just start seeing that you know that it's being used, and I started feeling, I would say, some of the behavioral stuff that goes along with that, and I just started asking questions. And I would say that both Alex and I came sort of to this about over 10 years ago, started really thinking about it, you know, from our own perspectives, and then started doing some serious research about what the role of pornography in our culture is. And we've been thinking about this for quite a while. And it was only a few years ago when we met with a forensic pediatrician who talked to us sort of about some of the deeper ways that the people she was seeing responded to pornography. So typically she was somebody who spoke for the prosecution, who testified for the prosecution of young men who were being prosecuted of downloading child pornography. And in one particular case, for the first time, she ended up testifying for the defense for a young man who had been seen by law enforcement to be downloading child pornography since he was 14 or 16,
yeah.
And they were watching him. He wasn't prosecuted until he was 18, and so what she began to understand was that there was a danger and a rabbit hole and something that went on in his psyche that caused her to start thinking there's a much bigger picture here.
So what have you been learning? You have really kind of pulled back the curtain on a sort of hidden world, both nationally and here in Vermont. And these are people who are clicking on porn sites and as a result finding themselves being convicted of various crimes. Tell me a little bit more about
there,
that.
What we found is there's a pattern now with a lot of these young men that are being prosecuted, and usually they start looking at online pornography at an early age. Now the average age is about 10 years old. That young males view hardcore online pornography. And so it becomes their first sexual experience to their 100th sexual experience. And there's being adolescence and the whole development of the prefrontal cortex and curiosity and wanting to see, you know, weird stuff and developing sexuality. We say it's a rabbit hole that they fall down. They start seeking out more and more graphic materials, and this from sexual to just violence. And inevitably, they come across child pornography. Child pornography, many people think, oh, you have to be in the dark web to encounter this stuff, but you don't. It's actually pretty easy. A lot of people say it's just 3 clicks away. And so what happens is these young males go onto these file sharing websites where there's lots and lots of pornography, and they just highlight a whole bunch of files. Start downloading them, go to bed, and then in the morning they just kind of pick through them and decide what they want, what they don't want. And many times, either intentionally or not intentionally, they download child pornography, and that's all you have to do. That is a crime. That's a felony offense in the United States, whether you intentionally did it or not.
We're talking with filmmakers Deb Ellis and Alex Halkin about a new documentary film they're making, End of Love, about the issue of child pornography, those in particular looking at people caught in the web of downloading child porn. You can join this conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. How does somebody who downloads pornography on the internet find themselves suddenly getting visited by law enforcement? How is that traceable? Alex?
Well, basically, what the FBI has many of these videos tagged. So they sit in an office somewhere, either locally or, you know, and federally, and just watch various individuals downloading these images, these videos, and they're able to identify the IP addresses that are downloading them. And so what ends up happening is there is a decision made, you know, if you're prosecuted federally for this offense, there are mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines. And so oftentimes a minimum sentence for downloading child pornography is 5 years. If it's a state, if it isn't taken by the federal government, and if it becomes a state offense, then there's more leeway. But essentially, the FBI and the federal government track many of these images, and if it's an underage person downloading them, many times they wait until they turn 18 so they can be prosecuted as an adult.
So in your film, you are finding, you've identified a number of these young men, and you interview them, and I've seen the trailer for your film, and you can tell us where to find that as well. Tell me about one of the young men who you're profiling in your film, End of Love. Deb?
One young man that we are profiling is a young man from Florida. He was a somewhat awkward high schooler. He had friends at school, oftentimes maybe didn't have friends at home, but otherwise, you know, came from a really nice family. He was sitting at home one day, and a SWAT team came into his house, and that's oftentimes what happens. His parents were at the vet with their dog. He and his sister were at home. He was 18 at that time. And because he had grown up really believing in the law, trusting police and whatnot, when he started being asked questions about what might be on his computer, he acknowledged that, yes, he did have stuff on his computer. He never imagined in the furthest reaches of his mind that it was going to end up in prison time and lifetime on the sex offender registry. And when we first met him, he was wearing an ankle monitor. He was a bright young man who had aspirations to be a history teacher, has a deep love of history. And so I think that's just a general portrait. Alex, I don't know if you have anything more to add to his story.
I think that there also, you know, with many of these young guys, there is a certain social awkwardness. And, you know, it's like everybody who's an adult remembers what it's like to be an adolescent and kind of figuring out, you know, your sexuality and how to date and things like that. And with online pornography, what's happening with a lot of these young males that are especially awkward socially is that it's much easier to have your sexual interactions online with your computer than it is with an actual human being.
So what's it mean to be put on the sex offender registry? You've seen the practical implications of that. Tell me about that, Deb Ellis.
Some of it depends on where you live, because different jurisdictions have different restrictions. One of the biggest issues that people on the sex offender registry have is where they can actually live. So some communities have laws that say that they have to be 2,500 feet from bus stops, playgrounds, schools, which effectively bans them from living in a town. Florida in general has very strict rules, and so there were a group of people, sex offenders, who live underneath a bridge right in the city of Miami because there was literally nowhere else for them to live. Other restrictions include...
There's problems with getting a job because it's a felony offense.
Oftentimes you have to tell your employee that you are a sex offender. If you have children, and, you know, ironically or not, a lot of them do have children, you're really banned from participating in any family activities.
Hmm. You mentioned one time when we've talked previously that you'd spoken to somebody in the U.S. Attorney's Office and what they've said about this crime and the volume of it. Talk about that a little bit, Alex.
Yeah, as you mentioned, David, in the beginning, it's one of the fastest-growing prosecuted crimes in the United States. And what's happening is that there's a lot of theories around why law enforcement is really focusing on child pornography offenses. I mean, one of the reasons that we feel and that other people who work in law enforcement and lawyers who represent people who have been prosecuted for child pornography possession feel that it's a very easy crime to prosecute. These are people who have never committed a crime before. It's all white, middle-class people. They're completely compliant. Again, as Deb mentioned earlier, the police show up, they tell them everything, they give them the computer, they're like, they just think, well, we're law-abiding citizens, we've never done anything wrong, nothing's going to happen. So it's actually a very easy crime for law enforcement to go after, and because of the amount of use of online pornography in the United States in general, there is so much of this crime happening just through the amount that is being consumed.
You know, your film kind of sheds a whole new light. When we hear sex offender, we naturally think of violent crime, crimes that involve, you know, non-consenting individuals. And this is something where there's a point in the trailer for your film where this young man who looks like any adolescent young kid that we may have or we may know, and he points to this laptop computer sitting in his closet, which is full of the usual pile of clothes that teenage boys would have, and he says, yeah, that's the thing that ruined my life, you know. So the tools of the crime here are not bloody knives or guns. In this case, it was a laptop. Who would you say are the victims of child pornography?
Well, there's many victims. I mean, obviously the primary victim are the children that are in the pornography. That's a question that we have is that, you know, in going after the consumers, they're not going after the people that are really creating the pornography. And you know, these young men who have their lives destroyed before they're even really adults. You know, when you get put on the sex offender registry, your picture, your address, your information is on the internet for everybody to see. And
in perpetuity.
In perpetuity.
You don't come off the registry.
You can, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult to get taken off the sex offender registry. And as everybody knows, once you're on the internet, you're on the internet. There's sites that have been created that take the information. They're kind of these vigilante sites that send out emails saying, you know, do you know who's in your neighborhood? And there's a lot of kind of feeding off of this fear of sex offenders in your neighborhood. But the fact is that most people in the United States have no information about who really is on the sex offender registry, what offenses put you on the sex offender registry. You can be put on the registry for a completely non-sexual crime. And also a very important fact is that most sexual offenses against children are committed by family members or friends of the family. It is not committed, they are not committed by some stranger living in a house on the corner. And so the whole concept of protecting people by putting them on the sex offender registry is really misleading, because it isn't, because it distracts the attention away from where the crimes really are committed to some ambiguous stranger in the neighborhood.
So you've been talking about downloading pornography, and we go on the internet. There's a whole lot of stuff, YouTube, whatever, that you just look at stuff. You don't think you're downloading anything. What does it mean? What's the difference between the stuff that you just see when you open a website and the stuff that you have to take a few more steps to actually put on your computer? Alex?
Well, most of in general, the ways that most of these males get access to child pornography is through BitTorrent websites like Pirate Bay. There's a number of them. And it's called file sharing. And so you just go up there, you type in a subject that you're interested in, and the files are all listed. You know, with pornography, it's unclear exactly what it is unless you really go and click on the link and see what it is, because of the names of pornography. It's very diverse and bizarre. And so what happens is these males, because this crime is predominantly a male crime, go and just bulk click on all these different files and then download them. It's a different thing than going to YouTube and just playing a video, because these files are being downloaded either onto your computer or onto an external hard drive.
So, Deb Ellis, you mentioned you have sons. With the research that you've been doing for The End of Love, the film that you're doing, what advice do you have for parents regarding porn and their children?
It's much easier being on this side of the picture than it was being the parent of a young man. And in retrospect, I think that I would pay a whole lot more attention to what was going on in closed rooms. I would be doing a lot of conversation with my son about sexuality. And by that, I mean, the pornographers are the ones who control your sexuality if you are spending that much of your time watching pornography. And there's no young male who really is interested in having somebody else control their sexuality. So I think starting to have that kind of a conversation with them can be one way to start talking to young men.
Do any of the programs that block people's access to adult sites, is it sort of fingers in a dike, just kind of futile to try and technologically stop this?
I think most kids can jump over anything that we know how to, that we think that we can block. So I would not trust them.
And Alex Halkin, with the work that you've been doing and meeting these young men, where does it lead you to, what kind of change do you think needs to happen in the laws that don't sweep up so many of the kind of people you're meeting?
Well, it really needs to be looked at as a rehabilitation process and not a criminal process. Putting 18-year-old males in federal prison for 8 years isn't helping anybody, and it's certainly not making children any safer in the United States. We feel that really there needs to be an intervention much earlier, since clearly law enforcement are tracking these young males way before they ever enter their homes. So there needs to be some kind of way to interact with these young men, let them know what they're doing is illegal, and also kind of do a little bit of work with them around their psychological issues and why they are looking at these images and what the implications are for looking at these images, because they're very disturbing images. You know, 10% of child pornography is infants. You know, people need to really understand the nature of this stuff. And so if we really care about protecting children, we really need to have an intervention much earlier with these young males.
What is your hope, both of you, Deb Ellis and Alex Halkin, that this film, when it comes out, The End of Love, that it will help to do? Deb Ellis?
I think our hope is that this film will help people engage in a conversation about pornography use and the role of pornography in our culture and how it affects our sexuality and our healthy development of the healthy sexuality of young men and women.
And Alex, I mean, when you figure you had mentioned earlier about the need to look at the focus here in the States is so much on the consumer end, but what about the children who are featured in these often violent, porn videos?
Well, I think it's a really profound question. You know, I think we really need to look at our culture and ask ourselves, why are we consuming this material? Why are so many people consuming this material? Why is there a demand to create more of this material? I mean, as a filmmaker, I don't have the answer for that, but I think it's, as Deb just said, I think it's a discussion that we really need to have in the United States and outside of the United States as well, because it's also produced outside of the United States. But as a culture, we need to really look at ourselves and say, what is happening here?
So tell me a little bit about the status of the film right now, where people can see the trailer. It is very compelling, just the little teaser that I saw online and hearing these young men speak. So tell us where it's at.
Right now, we are in the process of doing a fall fundraising campaign so that we can do some serious shooting this fall and winter, and you can find our website. It's endoflovefilm.com, and if you go to the Fund the Film link, you can see our teaser and get more information about the film.
When do you hope that the film will be done and viewable?
We anticipate the film will be completed by 2016, and so we're looking forward to that.
And how did you find subjects for this film? I mean, we opened by saying this is kind of a hidden story, and we only have a few seconds left, so
We reached out. There's a number of national networks that work around sex offender issues, and we reached out to them.
Okay. Well, Deb Ellis and Alex Halkin, their film in creation is End of Love. Thanks so much for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you need help with toys and clothes for your children's Christmas celebration and you live in Washington County, then listen carefully. The Salvation Army and Toys for Tots Christmas Program of Washington County has 7 days for you to get signed up. Go to the Salvation Army located at 25 Keith Avenue in Barrie and bring proof of address, income, bills, and ID for the family. Write down these dates. Monday, October 20th, 10 a.m. to noon. Tuesday, October 21st, 10 a.m. to noon and 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Monday, October 27th, 10 a.m. to noon. Tuesday, October 28th, 10 a.m. to noon. Monday, November 3rd, 10 a.m. to noon. Tuesday, November 4th, 10 a.m. to noon and 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. There will be a special sign-up day in Moortown on Wednesday, November 5th at the Church of the Crucified One on Route 100 from from 1 p.m. to 3. For more information, go to our website at vttoysfortots.com.
In response to the Ebola epidemic, the government is going to start fever screenings for travelers from West Africa at 5 airports.
JFK in New York, Newark Airport, Chicago O'Hare, Washington Dulles, and the airport in Atlanta.
That's White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest. The plan is to start the testing Saturday at JFK. Earnest says the administration has a lot of confidence in the current screening measures.
By far the most effective screening measure that is in place is not any screening that takes place here in the United States. It's the screening that takes place in these three countries in West Africa where they're experiencing this Ebola outbreak.
A man with Ebola from Liberia, Thomas Eric Duncan, died today in Dallas. Homeland Security agents at airports and other ports of entry already had begun observing travelers coming into the United States for potential signs of Ebola infection. AP Update, I'm Ed Donahue.
A community is more than houses on a street, more than schools and stoplights and stores. It's a place where you can't drive down the road without someone waving at you. Without people, there is no community. We're lucky. Lamoille County has a lot of good people. We want everyone to succeed, our children to regularly attend school and graduate on time, our families to have financial stability, good housing, and access to health care. At United Way, our work is about empowering people, giving them a hand up, not a hand out. Call us to find out how you can help. 888-3252.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Pleased to provide Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Underwriting is provided by National Life Insurance. Fairpoint Communications by Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemy Brewery, Fletcher Allen Healthcare, and Green Mountain Power, as well as over 750 VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where this week we're focusing on hidden voices in Vermont and around the country. In the last 25 years, the number of women and girls caught in the criminal justice system has skyrocketed. Many have been swept up in the war on drugs and subject to increasingly punitive sentencing policies for nonviolent offenders. There are now more than 200,000 women behind bars and more than 1 million on probation and parole. Many of these women struggle with substance abuse, mental illness, and histories of physical and sexual abuse. Here in Vermont, since January 2010, Writing Inside Vermont has forged relationships with over 200 of Vermont's incarcerated women. Weekly circles at the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility have provided space for women to write. Their writings have now been collected in a new book, Hear Me, See Me, which is edited by Mary Beth Christie Raymond and Sarah Bartlett. To talk about writing, women in prison, we have two guests. Sarah Bartlett, the co-founder of Writing Inside Vermont and co-editor of the new book, and Angela Avery, who has been incarcerated several times, is now free, and looks forward to telling the story of her life in a book that she's currently writing. Sarah and Angela, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, Dave.
Hello.
Sarah, let me start with you and ask you, what made you decide to work with women in prison?
That's a really good question, David. I have always been drawn to working with groups of women to find their voice and give them a way to use writing to both grow as individuals and make changes in their lives. So when I met Mary Beth, who was currently working on a book, and she was in one of my classes, I approached her because her book was about work she had done with an incarcerated man. And my training for the work that we used as the basis for Writing Inside had also exposed me to the population of incarcerated women. And when I was looking around up here, Jill Ellen Evans is the director of Family and Women Program in the DOC system, was looking for programs. So it was kind of a happy coincidence of timing and energy and ideas. And so it's been almost 5 years now that we have been working with the women in prison, and we followed them from St. Albans down to Chittenden, where they are now.
Now, there is only one women's prison in Vermont, and that's the one you work at. Is that right?
That is correct. any woman who is incarcerated in Vermont for whatever reason, for whatever length of time, is in that one facility.
Are you able to kind of give us a picture of how many women are incarcerated in Vermont and what they're behind bars for, typically?
Well, you touched on it, David. The facility has a maximum capacity of about 160 women. That number fluctuates from day to day. I wasn't inside this morning, so I don't know what today's headcount is. But a lot of women are in there for drug-related offenses and for returning, you know, recidivism, breaking parole, terms of parole. I've actually got Angie sitting here with me, and I suspect that she would like to address some of that, too, since she's actually been on the inside.
Okay, well, let's turn that to her. And Angela, or do you go by Angie, Angela?
I go by Angie or Angela or Avery.
Okay. So tell me what was going on in your life that landed you behind bars.
I was in mental health crisis and being denied help. And the hospital would tell me to leave, and I would persist that I needed help. And they would call the cops and have me arrested. And I'd get arrested for trespass and maybe things like disorderly conduct and simple assault and stuff like that.
How many times were you in jail?
I've been in jail several times. I've got like 50 convictions. And about 40 of them are trespasses at Fletcher Island.
So a trespassing charge will land you in jail?
Yes.
And how long are these stays typically? What has been the longest time that you've been incarcerated?
The longest I received was a 25 to 26 month sentence. It was reduced because of a situation that prisoners' rights got involved. So it was reduced down to about a year and a half.
Describe what it's like in prison. What is your daily routine, and what does the facility look like to you as a prisoner?
Well, for me, when things were good, it was actually very good for me. The structure was good. I went to every program that I could go to. The programs are limited right now. They really need to get more programs for people. But I went to every program that I could go to, and we spent time in the day hall playing cards, and I spent a lot of time drawing. I drew cards for the other girls to send to their families, and just to be nice. And I usually worked a third shift job in either the laundry or cleaning, or I did painting, and that helped, because I'm an insomniac and I don't sleep very well. Sometimes when there was issues, I'd be put in segregation, and usually there was a one-to-one with me.
And because, by segregation, does that mean solitary confinement?
Yeah. I was usually kept in a cell by myself, and somebody was usually outside the door watching me, and sometimes they would take everything out of the room, including the mattresses, and they'd put me in a suicide smock, but I would hang myself with it, and then they'd leave me bare butt naked and with Ben watching me. and cameras on me, and I wouldn't even have a mattress, and it was pretty traumatizing.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're talking with Angela Avery, a former prisoner in a women's prison in Vermont, and Sarah Bartlett, who's the co-editor of a new book, Hear Me, See Me, Incarcerated Women Write. Sarah Bartlett, can you talk about the first time you went into a prison to run a writer's group? What was it like for you?
Well, I'm not going to lie, as my daughter would say. It was challenging. There was a lot of waiting. A lot of people needed to check papers, check my person. I had to take off shoes and coats and things. There were restrictions on the dress. Had to have closed-toed shoes. Things that I don't even think about now, but the very first time I remember it was kind of shocking. But I think the toughest physical part was the noise. Every passage from one place to another was wait, there's a buzzer, somebody sees you, they buzz you through one set of doors, heavy metal doors that clang behind you, and then you're sort of in this dead space waiting for the next set of doors to buzz you through. So there's a lot of that sort of noise, the sense of being locked in, and the actual running of the group was constantly punctuated by these doors slamming and reverberating in the halls. Also, the scheduling was a challenge. I mean, it took us 6 months to even get in the door for a variety of reasons. But once we did, and we had the full support of DOC staff and administration, the challenge and a great interest among the women, the challenges nonetheless, which continue to this day, are women actually showing up. We finally, after trial and error, came up with the idea of just having them sign up week by week. And the woman who comes on a regular basis, as Angela did, she was there every single week she could, would be invited back, but new women would sign up. And so from a list that could vary from 4 to 16 people, we might have a core group of, I'd say, 8 to 12 each week. But even women who wanted to come would have something come up at the last minute. They wouldn't be feeling well. They'd be tired. They'd been working and overslept. They got bad news from home. They didn't get the letter or the phone call they were hoping for. I mean, there's a sense of kind of chaos and unpredictability from the standpoint of a visitor inside, whereas I see and understand Angie's perspective that the structure is really helpful because, meals are at the exact same time every day. And in our case, our group met at the exact same time. Thursday evening is the time we've had for 5 years. We go, we show up. Whether anyone else shows up or not, we're there, we're consistent. So we create a sense of expectation and reliability for women. Which I think is one of the critical things that's made our program both popular and successful and still ongoing.
Angela Avery, what made you decide to go to a writing group once you heard about it?
Well, I always liked writing, and at first it was a reason to go to a group, and the fact that it was a writing group, I thought it would be interesting, and once I got to the group, I was hooked. It just inspired me, and off I was running. I started writing all the time and adding it to my art.
Could you read us something that you wrote for the book, Hear Me, See Me?
Sure. It's called I Can't Just Let It Go. Do you hear voices? Yes. Do you see people or things that others can't see? Yes. What do they say? What do you see? They're scary, but not at first. They look kind and friendly, comforting as can be. They say they'll be my friend or take care of me. Then as it progresses, everything progressively starts to change. They turn into monsters, and then I know they're evil and want to take my soul from me. Why don't you relax? Don't worry so. You'd feel so much better if you'd just let it go. It always the same. I cry in shame. I'm a joke, an excuse for others to bitch. The resentments and worries are what people see and profess and describe me. Again, I'm the ass, and it's stuck in my heart and mind and torments me. There's so many people, both inside and out, and they all got big mouths without a doubt. Then there's the little of me that is real, so people get to know a part most don't see. Experience things I still enjoy and sometimes get to share. I get to show I'm human and make them aware.
That's Angela Avery, a formerly incarcerated woman from Vermont prison, reading from an essay she wrote for the book Hear Me, See Me, Incarcerated Women Write, which is co-edited by Sarah Bartlett, our other guest on today's show. Angela, what was the feeling that you were trying to convey in that essay?
Well, we had a topic that, like a poem that we read at the beginning of the group, and we took a line from it, and we wrote about it, and that's what came out from what I got out of that line. And I tried to portray that, well, people don't always understand me with my mental illness, and I'm often misunderstood, and it can lead to problems in my life and help, and the help I get, and it sets up limits and how people relate to me.
What did it mean to you, Angela, to see your writing in a book?
Oh, it was so exciting. I was like on top of the world and really felt accomplished when I was at the first book signing. I was like, felt so big. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to go to the second book signing that they had, but unfortunately I was incarcerated again. And then I made it to the third book signing at the book festival, which was really big.
Huh. Sarah Bartlett, what is your hope for the program, Writing Inside Vermont?
Well, honestly, David, you know, it's interesting how much press the book has gotten, but the book was a pure accident. We did not go in with the idea of doing this. We have a blog in which we post women's writings every week, and there was a reader on the blog who was a former editor who said, gosh, this would make a great collection. You know, so we did gather them together, and I want to make two quick points. One is that the writing that you heard and all the writing in the book is done in 15 to 20 minute fast writes. It's not edited. It's not polished in any way. These are just, you know, the women sat down and wrote to the prompt. So I think that's a remarkable thing that they could have such insight and put it down so succinctly, you know, in such short time. The hope that I have for the program is really just to keep on creating an opportunity for women to have a venue for that kind of expression, and to be able to look at their writing, look back at it over time, and see how they've grown and how they've changed, and be able to have their words be a tool for their own personal transformation. And that's really what we're about, and that's why the week after the book launched, we were back inside as if the book had never happened. You know, it was sort of a happy glitch, but it's really the program and the weekly writing, the connection with the women, giving them a lifeline. The second point I just wanted to make really quickly was that Angela's an example of a very high percentage of women inside who have significant mental health issues, and the programming really does not exist for them. For a number of them, they really shouldn't be in prison. And I think her experience with the hospital and with all the trespass charges that got her in is partly how she managed to play the system so that she could be safe, so she could feel safe when she really couldn't out in the community.
Hmm.
So it's been a really interesting journey for me. I've learned a lot by working with these women.
What kind of transformations have you observed among the participants in the program?
Well, there have been numerous. I mean, one is Angie herself. Her resolve to stay on the outside, even when times are really tough for her. We've just recently started an outside writing group, and we met last night. She read a piece to us that she wrote when she was having a really tough night the night before, and she said it was the writing that kept her going. Now, this is a very different Angie from 3 years ago, who would have just taken herself to the ER and sat there until they took her into prison as a way of coping. So I see that as a huge example of her beginning to really take control of her down times and finding a way that she can self-soothe and that she can manage and that she can hang on to something that will get her through to the dawn, literally. We've had a couple of really fabulous experiences where family members have been reading the women's words on the blog and have written to us and said, wow, you know, I didn't realize my sister or my daughter really felt that way or had turned this corner, or, you know, I now really want to get back in touch and give her a second chance. So we've seen family reunification. We've seen deepened understanding. We've seen individual striving to really do it differently, to find new tools for coping.
Have you thought of expanding this program to male prisoners?
I personally have not. I know there are people who write with male prisoners, and I know it's obviously a fabulous program, but my background is with a program that's actually national in scope called Women Writing for a Change. I'm trained and licensed, have a program of that name that's been here for 10 years. It's really an outgrowth of that work that I've been doing. And even though I do workshops and other groups in mixed company or for men, my passion is really for bringing the voices, as you say, the hidden the voices of the hidden women and girls forward, and to give them the confidence to speak their truths regardless of what's going on, and not to feel cowed by their experience, their history, or the people around them.
Angie.
So I don't have plans, no, to broaden it beyond that, but I do have three components to the program currently.
Hmm. Angie Avery, Sarah was just saying that, expressing that you want to stay outside of prison and that that's your wish. What is it going to take for you to stay outside of prison now?
Well, I have a very decent... a case manager now. Her name's Patty, and she is very different from the other case managers that I've had, and I really appreciate her. She's a very powerful lady, and she even helped me get an appeal so that I could get the housing that I have. I have a really nice apartment now, and I have a lot of support through church and other organizations like Mercy Connections and RUN2. Well, it's the Pride Center now, and I'm taking classes called Depth and I'm in the IOP program at Howard Center, and I'm doing what it takes. I'm also in some Celebrate Recovery at Community Bible Church, and I'm doing what it takes to learn how to grow, and I'm doing it, and I'm also getting my health better through support on an online group called Diabetic Treatment Alternatives, where I'm learning a new diet. So my diabetes is getting in control.
Do you have another short piece you'd like to you could read to close us out here?
Which one should I do?
You have quite a few in this book, Hear Me, See Me. I think you're one of the most published writers in here, judging from the index.
How? You want one from the book?
Do you... Sarah's picking one out right now.
Okay.
I found that I had to get all aspects of my life in order in order to stay out of trouble, and it took a while to realize that I wasn't going to stay out of jail until I got all aspects of my life took care of, and I'm doing that. But here's the poem that I'm going to read. It's called Not Done Trying What I'll Be.
Okay.
It's trying to be what I am not. It's the only hope for the life I've got. It takes away the stories that other people have often sought. They didn't want the truth. They didn't care to hear my plan. I don't think they were capable to let me think I can. They always tell me no. When I try to stay, they tell me go. When I say I must go, that's in their control also. So I will do my time in jail. To some, it means I fail. If they could see what I can see, they'd see I've won. Go to hell, my ship's a sail. I have to work because I get up in pain. As it's hard, I know I shouldn't complain. When I go all out, it's strength I gain. It makes my heart know why I came. It will be a long time. I got another record on my list of crime. But it will be over, and then it will be fine. Because I'll stick out my thumb where I go, then the choice will be mine.
Okay. Well, Angela Avery, I want to thank you for sharing your writing with us, and Sarah Bartlett for telling us about writing Inside Vermont this week.
Thank you very much.
That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows on VermontConversation.com, and we'll be back next week, Wednesday at 1, here on WDEV.
You've been listening to Vermont Conversations with David Goodman. Listen Wednesdays at 1 as Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and their some 750 members, along with additional support from National Life and